Amen. Now, the transition from Daniel 4 to Daniel 5 is a bit of an abrupt one. We have Belshazzar, who was thrust onto the stage really with no indication of the passage of time or the death of Nebuchadnezzar. We had just read about Nebuchadnezzar in another dream that he had had and a humbling experience that he had had. But in this chapter, Daniel tells us about Belshazzar. And at this time, Belshazzar was king of Babylon and would ultimately be the last Chaldean king of Babylon. And then we're also told that Nebuchadnezzar was his father. But here's the interesting part. Until the last half of the 19th century, there were actually no other records regarding Belshazzar, right? We had no historical documents or tablets, right, or artifacts that mentioned Belshazzar. And in fact, instead, the only historical records that we had were listed Nabonidus as a king of Babylon at this time. And so for many years, liberal critics said that this Belshazzar was actually just a fictional character invented by the author of Daniel, right? Remember, they also think that Daniel didn't actually write Daniel, that it was written much, much later. And so they think, you know, this is just an invention of the author. And so how do we explain that? Well, as has happened plenty of times in the past, archaeology can now confirm the biblical account. 37 archival texts dated from the 1st to the 14th year of Nabonidus can now attest to Belshazzar's historicity. And so we know now from both the Bible and from extra-biblical history that Belshazzar did in fact exist and that he was in fact the son of Nabonidus and was actually reigning as co-regent at this time in history. And so Nabonidus was indeed king, but so was Belshazzar, right? They were co-reigning together during this period of time. And it was Belshazzar who was in charge of the city when it fell to the Persians. And we're going to see this exactly unfold, right, as Daniel tells us. And so we'll see Nabonidus sort of alluded to in verse 7 and in some other verses, though he's not mentioned by name, simply because he doesn't play any part in the event described in this chapter. Because in fact, he's off fighting the Persians. And so right now, Babylon is at war with the Persian army who is sweeping through the land. And so Nabonidus, Belshazzar's father, is out, you know, the one leading the charge. And so for all practical purposes, Belshazzar was the only king that the people are serving at this time. And so he's the only king that Daniel writes about. And so just another example that should serve to affirm our faith in God's word, right? And granted, we don't have archaeological evidence for everything, you know, in the Bible, but those bits that we do only go to validate everything else as the accurate word of God. Now, chapter 4 focused on Nebuchadnezzar's pride, and chapter 5 will also focus on Belshazzar's pride. The major difference between chapter 4 and chapter 5 is in the response of the king. Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4 ultimately repented of his arrogance and was restored to his former position by God. In chapter 5, however, Belshazzar does not repent and is killed. And the Greek historians Herodotus and Xenophon both write about this date, and they write about the events that are described here in regards to the fall of Babylon. And so they date this as happening on October 12th, 539 BC. And so this would make this about 30 or 40 years after the events of chapter 4. Okay, so in between those 30 or 40 years, Nebuchadnezzar has died, and Nabonidus is co-reigning with his son Belshazzar. And this would actually put then Daniel in his 80s at this point, right? And so we're pretty much now kind of toward the end of Daniel's life. Remember that in chapter one, he was probably in his early teens, 13, 14, around that age. And so a long time has passed for Daniel between chapter one and chapter five. And so let's go ahead and we'll jump into the text. And I'll ask TJ if you could read for us verses 1-4.
Daniel chapter 5, verses 1-4. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone.
All right, so recall that at the beginning of chapter 1, we were told that Nebuchadnezzar had taken not only some of the brightest young men in Jerusalem, such as Daniel and his friends, but he also took many of the vessels from the temple, right? And I'd mentioned then that we would come back to those, and so here we are. And of course, it was bad enough when Nebuchadnezzar looted the temple and stole this gold and these silver vessels in the first place, or they were given to him, however that took place. But now even worse, Belshazzar and his friends are using them in a drunken feast while they praise their false gods and their false idols. Maybe just a quick detour, and this will set us up for the end of the chapter. The interesting part of this is what is going on outside the city walls during this time. Possibly unbeknownst to Belshazzar and his court, the Persian armies were actually camped outside the city walls at this time, right? And according to the Nabonidus Chronicles, the Babylonians, or the Chaldeans, led by Belshazzar's father, Nabonidus, had suffered a crushing defeat just days before at the hands of the Persians. And so the records that we have, right, that Nabonidus had fled as a result. So he's fled from that defeat with his tail tucked between his legs. And so really, only the city of Babylon remains unconquered at this point, as far as this Babylonian empire. And the Nabonidus Chronicles also tell us that the army of Cyrus entered Babylon without any battle, right? There was no fighting necessary for them to take this glorious city with this impenetrable wall. And we're going to see precisely that. Right, Daniel 5 will tell us that. And so again, we have validation of events from both biblical and non-biblical sources, right? The non-biblical sources tell us that Cyrus took Babylon without a fight, and we see exactly that in chapter 5 here. Either way, or rather, and so if Persia is camped outside the city, why is Belshazzar throwing a feast in the middle of this war? Right, especially when the rest of his empire, had fallen, and now the enemy is quite literally at the gate. Perhaps it could have been to rally and encourage the leaders. Maybe it was to give the people a diversion in the face of this Persian onslaught. Maybe it was, more of the mentality, let us eat, drink, and be merry for today, today, for tomorrow we die. Perhaps it was a bit of all three. Perhaps Belshazzar was simply trying to drown his fears with alcohol, right? Either way, he shows his pride and he shows his arrogance as he uses these vessels dedicated to the temple in this drunken feast. And so that's the setup to this chapter. Comments or questions through verse 4? Ben, if you could read for us verses 5-12, please.
Okay. Suddenly, the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Then the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints went slack, and his knees began knocking together. The king called aloud to bring the conjurers, the Chaldeans, and the diviners. The king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me shall be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold around his neck and have authority as third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the inscription or make known its interpretation to the king. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed. His face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed. The queen entered the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles. The queen spoke and said, "O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of your father, illumination, insight, and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation."
So suddenly, at the height of Belshazzar's blasphemy and drunkenness and immorality, the revelry stopped. Right? It wasn't because of a trumpet blast or an earthquake or any kind of fanfare. Suddenly out of nowhere, a hand appears and the fingers are seen writing four words on the wall, and then the hand vanishes. I can't even imagine what that would have been like, or how I might have reacted to that. Nathan had mentioned back in chapter 3, I believe it was, the colorful language that Daniel uses. And here he describes the king as going pale and his hip joints, going slack and his knees knocking together, right? He was quite literally, quaking in his boots. And I can just imagine him, right, in his drunken panic, probably screaming out for his wise men, right? Screaming in panic. And that seems to be almost the standard response for the king. Something strange and mystical happens. Call the wise men. But as has also been seen as a standard in Daniel is how ineffective they are when true supernatural events transpire. Now, even so, Belshazzar makes the promise to reward whoever can interpret the words on the wall with purple clothing and with gold, and even to be the third highest ruler in the land. I find it interesting that these kings certainly have a habit of offering these very large rewards. If I'm going to employ a court of wise men, I would expect them to do their job without having to promise these grand things each time. But maybe that's just me. At the same time, just given the reward and the size of the reward, I'm surprised that there aren't any who try to just fake it, right? And maybe make something up. So it makes me wonder why none of them actually try to do that. But alas, they remained perplexed at what the words could possibly mean. And so the king grows even more alarmed, right? And even paler than before. No doubt the alcohol probably isn't helping him stay very calm at the moment. But notice in verse 7 how the king says, any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me shall be clothed, with purple and have a necklace of gold and be the third highest ruler. And so it's interesting that he says, any man who can read this inscription, right? And so there's some debate on whether what language these words were written in, right? Or if the king meant really, interpret them, or possibly they were words that could be read, but absent any context, they just didn't understand the meaning, right? Because Daniel is able to come in and read these words. And so I think the common agreement is that the words written were in fact still in Aramaic, right? So if that were the case, then they could have been read by these wise men. They just didn't know what it meant. Especially because there's some wordplay taking place. And so if they were in a different language that they didn't understand, then Daniel would have had to have translated them. And that doesn't really work out. That may not work as nicely when we get to this wordplay section. So just kind of a fun fact there. But what I find humorous, though, is if indeed these words were written in Aramaic, which means they should have been able to at least read them, is the fact that there is confusion about language in the first place, right? Because if you remember, how did Babylon begin back in Genesis 11, right? It began with the confusion of languages, right? As they tried to build a tower of Babel, God said, let us go down and confuse their language so that they will be scattered. And so God is taking them out the same way that they came in. And so for me, that only goes to show that God does in fact have a sense of humor. So here's the challenge, right? So these wise men come in, they can't make any sense of these words despite this great reward. And it's not until the queen comes in, and this is likely the queen mother, right? So this is probably not Belshazzar's wife, most likely his mother or someone. Maybe even from Nebuchadnezzar's days, as she seems to be very familiar with Daniel. And so she comes in and she tells Belshazzar of Daniel. I'm not really sure of Daniel's place in the court at this point. We know during Nebuchadnezzar's days, he was the chief of the magicians, right? Chief of the wise men. I'm not sure if that's still the case. I don't get the impression that he is, just given what is said, right? Given Belshazzar's kind of lack of thought to maybe ask of him and the queen having to explain who he is. Most likely I'm thinking that maybe just given his age, he's probably retired at this point. Again, he's in his 80s. Either way, we see again that Daniel is still being called last, right? So he's not called first, he's called last. Again, makes me wonder if there isn't some divine influence there, right? God making sure that Daniel is called for last, because he's working through Daniel, and he wanted to show, right, that God would be the only one who could accomplish these things, right? Wanted to show the ineffectiveness of these wise men, so that only displays the divine providence of God to accomplish these things. And so he gives everyone a chance to fail first. Comments or questions through verse 12?
I kind of find it just a little interesting that, if the Persian army is around the gates and about to take over Babylon, that Belshazzar is sitting here going to put someone into the third highest position in the kingdom right as they're about to get taken over.
Absolutely. And we'll find, I'll have a follow-up question to that when we read this next section that maybe has some relevance to that notion, but the fact that he's having this banquet and this feast is definitely odd, right? So maybe he's in denial of all this. Nathan, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I do think he does not believe they're going to fall, at least that quickly. He thinks he's offering them something. He has trust probably in the fortifications of Babylon. But in addition to that, you know, I think, you know, this story does illustrate the danger in forgetting or neglecting the wisdom of the old. You know, even in our day, people are more drawn to youthful excitement and zeal. And that's not necessarily the medicine that is needed to solve the problem or cure the issues that may be at hand. And Daniel was sadly, to some degree, a forgotten relic of the past when really, again, he was the one who had the answers to their problems. And Belshazzar, of course, until the queen mother comes in, is not going to see what they need. And he probably could have learned a lot from his fathers and from people from his father's kingdom like Daniel.
Absolutely. It's a great thought. And we'll see, of course, next chapter. King Darius, you know, does recognize Daniel's wisdom and the value that he brings, and does take advantage of that. Other comments or questions?
I would just say, in all likelihood, yeah, I mean, Belshazzar, they, you know, in their arrogance, they think that they're invulnerable. They think that the walls of Babylon cannot be breached. And in some ways they're right, but the Persians are more clever. And I'm sure you'll talk about that at the end. But they think, yeah, they think that they're safe. That Babylon can't, the walls of Babylon cannot fall. And so yeah, in their arrogance, they carried away, party.
Right. And you know, remember, the walls of Babylon were one of the ancient wonders of the world, right? You know, several miles long. You know, I think last time we mentioned it was like 25 feet wide. These are massive walls, right? And before the age of artillery, they're sort of unbreachable walls. And so we can see why, while Belshazzar might be so arrogant that he's safe, and he's also probably a little drunk, and that might be clouding his judgment as well. We'll go ahead and continue. So, Carl, if you could read for us now 13 through 24.
Okay, beginning with verse 13. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard of you, that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not give the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of you, that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple, and have a chain of gold around your neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself, and give the rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing to the king, and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. But you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. And you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives and your concubines, have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. Then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and this writing was written.
All right. So Belshazzar relays the story of what happened, and he offers Daniel the same reward that he offered the others if he could read the inscription and interpret it. But Daniel refuses the gifts. You know, does anyone have any thought on why that may have been, right? Why do you think Daniel would refuse these gifts? He had accepted them before when Nebuchadnezzar had offered them. So why is he refusing them now, you think?
I think it's likely because he knows that the honors bestowed by Belshazzar don't really mean very much right now. They're not going to last very long.
Yeah, you know, likely, you know, Daniel knew that someone else would, you know, Babylon would not last forever. And so maybe that's the reason. Nathan?
It could also have something to do with the fact that if he was to be in a position of honor at the time of the invasion, that's, you know, I don't think the lords and nobles are going to be in a very good position. I'd rather be, again, that forgotten old guy who's left in a room somewhere, abandoned, you know, insignificant. You know, that's going to be the better position that night.
Yeah, that could very well be the case as well. And, you know, typically the leadership of the conquered, you know, don't typically last very long once they are conquered. So that, you know, there's a few different reasons, right? Daniel probably knew that neither Belshazzar nor the Chaldean kingdom were going to last through the night, you know, literally. And so in that sense, right, these promised gifts were sort of meaningless. Perhaps because Daniel knew that would mean he would have to get involved in politics or whatever, you know, the kind of equivalent in this ancient era. And again, he's likely retired. And probably doesn't want to serve under someone like Belshazzar. Either way, Daniel does say that he will interpret the message. But before he does, he gives the king a history lesson. And he also gives them a stern reprimand. And so in verse 19, Daniel reminds Belshazzar that Nebuchadnezzar was an absolute sovereign. Right, he could dispense life and death at his whim, unlike Belshazzar, who seems to be much less powerful and mighty. You know, would Nebuchadnezzar have spent the night in a drunken feast while his enemy camped outside the city? Right, that is not what we know of Nebuchadnezzar. He was certainly one to lean toward the military, right, and he was sort of he was great at that. You know, maybe to paraphrase a famous quote of a Texas senator. You know, Daniel is telling the king, you know, I knew Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was a friend of mine, and you, sir, are no Nebuchadnezzar. Right? The great Nebuchadnezzar had submitted eventually to God's sovereignty, while Belshazzar, who was hardly worth anything, right? He was hardly worthy to be compared with the earlier king, right? And the fact that Belshazzar knew the events, right? We're told that Nebuchadnezzar knew, or Belshazzar knew what had happened to Nebuchadnezzar, right? He had heard the story of Nebuchadnezzar being humbled and acting like an animal in the field and eating with the beasts. And he had heard of the power of God, and yet he still chooses to profane his name by using these vessels of the temple. And so for Daniel, you know, it was one thing for Nebuchadnezzar to have conquered Jerusalem and taken the holy vessels as trophies, but it was in a different matter entirely to have used those vessels in the manner which Belshazzar was this night. You know, in other words, Nebuchadnezzar was great, but he was filled with pride. And initially he refused to give the glory to God. But as bad as Nebuchadnezzar's punishment was, Belshazzar's punishment was going to be even worse. And Daniel tells the king in verse 22 that the king, again, you knew all of this, but had not learned from the past. Do you get the feeling that maybe Belshazzar is already regretting having summoned Daniel? You know, if he had wondered what could be worse than having his feast interrupted by a writing finger, well, he was finding out what would have been worse, right? Being reprimanded in front of his wives and his concubines and then all these other officials. Comments or questions, or other comments or questions through verse 24. All right, well, let's go ahead and read the conclusion to this. And so, Roy, if you could read for us verses 25 through 31.
Harper?
Oh, before you do, Carl, did you have something?
I just want to say, I do think it is kind of interesting, you know, and it could speak to the relationship between David and Nebuchadnezzar and David and Belshazzar. It could reflect the fact that David's an old man and doesn't really have to worry about what he does. He was always very respectful in his language to Nebuchadnezzar. And that probably speaks something to them. He's not. Yeah, that kind of language. It's not just a respect for the office of the king. Right, because it's clearly not present here.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely a shift in attitudes here. Roy, that may have been you that I just muted just because it sounded like there was some feedback as Carl was talking, so you'll have to unmute yourself again.
Okay, you want me to go ahead and read now?
Yes, sir. Thank you. 25 through 31.
Okay. Verse 25. Now, this is the inscription that was written out. Many, many tekel upharsin. This is the interpretation of the message. Many, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. That same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at the age of 62.
So Daniel finally interprets the four words on the wall. Many, many tekel upharsin. Right? Literally, they meant numbered, weighed, and divided. You know, many, which is repeated twice, you know, meant that God had numbered the days of Belshazzar's reign down to the very last day and down to the very last hour. Right? So certain was the fulfillment that many is in fact written twice, right? Kind of emphasizing. You know, if the king had ever wondered just how long he would reign as king, or maybe just live for that matter, well, now he knew. You know, the count was complete. Both his days and the days of his kingdom had been numbered, and they were both about to come to a swift end. And then this third word, tekel, right, which meant weighed. Daniel explains that Belshazzar had been weighed and been found wanting. You know, he did not measure up. You know, we could say he was a classic example of a lightweight ruler. And so he was found deficient. And I think from what we've seen so far, and how Belshazzar is acting, that is absolutely the case. And then finally, this a parson, right? And verse 25 says a parson, but then verse 28 says Perez. And this is where that wordplay comes in. Now the U in front of farson essentially just means and, right? So it's a conjunction. And so it's, you know, counted, weighed, and divided, right? And the word farson is actually just the plural of Perez, right? So those two words are the same, even though Daniel uses those two different words. You know, farson is just the plural form of Perez. And so they could be used interchangeably. And that just meant divided, right? Or to divide. But with some wordplay, it also meant Persian, right? So Daniel is explaining that Belshazzar's kingdom had been divided and instead given to the Medes and the Persians, who we said at the time were besieging the city, right? And so there's some interesting wordplay. Again, God is not without a sense of humor, I think, right? So the king's days had been numbered. He had been found wanting. And now his kingdom was going to be divided and given to the Medes and the Persians, right, who were literally knocking at the door. Comments or questions through verse 28? Well, even though Daniel had given the king some rather bad news, in my opinion, Belshazzar was true to his word, and he makes Daniel a king for a day, not even a day, a night, essentially. You know, you might have thought Belshazzar would have had Daniel killed on the spot for saying such things, right? For saying, again, you know, he'd reprimanded him, and now he'd been saying that God has found you lacking, right? Found you deficient in front of all the audience who are present. But maybe Belshazzar doesn't want to appear untrue to his word in front of his guests, and so he honors the reward. Though if the king had survived the night, you know, maybe Daniel might have feared after that once the guests were gone. Or maybe the king had also thought that, well, maybe Daniel's God would change his mind if I spare Daniel and I still give him these gifts, right? So maybe he's thinking, maybe I'll get some mercy from Daniel's God. You know, who knows what's going through the king's mind at this time. But recall that Daniel had initially refused the gifts, right? But in verse 29, it sounds like he's sort of forced to accept him at that point, right? And so it doesn't sound like he has much choice in the matter here. But most likely, I think that Daniel knew that these gifts were meaningless, right? Given what was about to transpire. You know, what good was it to be proclaimed the third ruler in an empire that was about to collapse only, you know, in a few hours? And then finally, in verses 30 and 31, maybe with its typical understatement of world events, the Bible uses only a few words to report one of the most significant events, right, in the ancient world history, which is the fall of the Babylonian Empire, right? This head of gold that that Nebuchadnezzar had been equated to, right? Kind of this empire with an emperor who had absolute authority, right? Absolute monarchy with these impregnable and these impenetrable walls had fallen, right? Who would have ever thought Babylon could fall? And so it falls, and it's now the beginning of the Medo-Persian Empire, right, of the Medes and the Persians. And so that very night, the city fell, and with its last remnants, and with it, the last remnants of the Babylonian dominance, right, of the Chaldean people who were at the time the Babylonian Empire. And Belshazzar was executed, right, that very night. Now, according to the Nabonidus Chronicle, we mentioned at the beginning, right? So this was the 16th of the month of Tishri, which most scholars would have agreed was October 12th, 539 BC. which meant that the banquet would have been held on the night before, right? So October 11th. So it was that kind of that next morning overnight as the Persians came. And then maybe some fun facts. If you're interested in knowing how this happened, right? Again, how could the Persians get inside the walls without a fight? And here's that cleverness that Carl alluded to. And so the Greek historians Herodotus and Xenophon tell us just how the Medes and the Persians took the city, right? So keep it in mind that the walls of Babylon were one of the ancient wonders of the world, right? They were huge. The outermost system was 17 miles in length, 25 feet wide, and at least 40 feet high, right? So kind of picture that in your mind. Very wide and very tall and very thick. Before gunpowder and artillery, right, they would have been just too difficult to overcome them directly. And so what the Persians did was they diverted the river. And so if you don't know, the river Euphrates cuts through the city of Babylon, right? So the Babylon is sort of built on top of this river, and that's their fresh water supply. And so what they do is they dam the river farther upstream, and they divert the water so that the level of the river is lowered enough that the soldiers could wade through the river and under the walls, right? Under the city gates, or the gate that would have normally blocked that passage. And so as everyone is distracted by their drunken revelry, the Persians literally walk in and take the city without ever having to fight for it, right? Everyone's drunk anyways, and they're all probably asleep by this point. And so the Persians, through their cleverness, divert the river and walk in. And that is the end of the Babylonian Empire. And then in chapter 6, we'll have some brief narrative about Darius, or King Darius, and his relationship with Daniel. And then after chapter 6, we get into Daniel's visions itself. Any final questions or thoughts through the end of chapter 5? Ben?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it was back when we were studying Jeremiah, but several of the prophets, when it was noted that the land of Judah was going to fall to Babylon, the resident there, the Jews, said it just can't be because they're so wicked. And God kept sending the message that, yes, you're going to fall to Babylon, and I will hold them accountable. And it was prophesied against them. They were so, in carrying out God's judgment, they were excessively cruel, and God was going to hold them accountable. And that's what's so interesting about this. At the end of when the Jews' captivity is coming to an end, they're going to be returned by the Medes and the Persians, by Cyrus. The message that he was going to hold Babylon accountable for their sins against him, everything is coming to fruition just as God's message always does. And I'll stop there.
And we saw something similar with the Assyrians and Israel, right? The Assyrians have gone too far in their treatment of the northern kingdoms, and God uses Babylon to conquer Assyria. Now we're seeing that God is using the Medes and the Persians to conquer Babylon for their part and for their atrocities that they committed against God's people. Again, we see kind of the theme, God is in control, right, of the nation. Stuart, I think you were next.
Yeah, kind of branching off that thought, going off an interesting thought. It's really interesting how they're praising the God.
You're a little quiet. They can hardly hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Much better.
Okay. I was saying, going off those thoughts that have been just said, it's interesting how, they're worshiping the gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, as we saw twice in this past chapter. And, not too long ago, we had that the vision of the statue, right, being made of some of these materials. And Daniel's prophecy then, interpretation of that is, you know, the kingdom will come to an end and Nebuchadnezzar and his reign will be brought low. And so it's just interesting. Did they not know that, or did they not heed the warning? And you see the difference between the previous chapter and this chapter. It seems like Nebuchadnezzar understood, but, you know, who knows what happened between him and Belshazzar, his son. It just doesn't seem like that lesson was passed down. But again, as you said, it comes back to God is in control, and we see the prophecy being fulfilled.
I think there is absolutely an opportunity for Belshazzar to have learned from his forefathers. You know, one thing I like to say, it's, you know, definitely we should learn from our mistakes. I think the wise, though, learn from other people's mistakes first, before they have to make them themselves. And so Nebuchadnezzar had been a great example, right? And if only Belshazzar had not only heard, which he did, of what happened to Nebuchadnezzar, but also have learned from it. So unfortunately, he didn't. And so God has brought judgment. Carl.
Yeah, I was just going to say when we're talking about how Belshazzar treated Daniel, we seem to see in the pagan kings a great fear and respect for the supernatural, for their wise men, right? And they can clearly see that Daniel's gift is real, and so they even fear him the most. And respect him the most. And it's just a contrast to the kings of Judah who don't respect the prophets at all, who see the prophets as an obstacle, and they may hear that this comes from God, and even if they think it comes from God, they throw them in a pit. That their attitude and their respect for the gift that the prophets are manifesting is so different. It's striking between the pagan kings and between the supposed kings of Judah, or supposed godly kings of Judah.
That's a great point. I hadn't made that connection in reading this, and that's absolutely, that is very interesting relationship and dichotomy there.